The following program is being brought to you on the Voice America. The following program is being brought to you on the Voice America Business Channel. For more information about our network and to check our additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericabusiness.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live internet talk radio. Visit Voice America.
Time for Capital Thinking, where we analyze the key policy, political, legal, and business issues that will shape America's future. Live from Washington, D.C., this is your unfiltered tour of the halls of power. Now, here's your host, Kevin O'Neill.
Good afternoon, listeners, and welcome to Voice of America's Capital Thinking. I am not Kevin O'Neill, but I am Todd Cranford, guest hosting for my colleague, Kevin. Today, we'll have several knowledgeable guests. We're going to discuss a number of topics of interest to attorneys and their clients. We're going to begin with Mr. Peter Buckley. Peter's a litigation associate at the law firm of Fox Rothschild's Philadelphia office, where he has a diverse practice that is focused on commercial, real estate, and bankruptcy litigation, ranging from private individuals to small businesses to Fortune 100 corporations and AmLaw 200 law firms. Peter represents clients in both state and federal court, as well as in arbitration forums. Welcome, Peter.
Thanks, Todd. I appreciate the opportunity.
So today I understand you have some advice and maybe some caveats and vignettes on representing attorneys in malpractice matters.
That's right. And one of the things that I do a good time of my practice is represent lawyers, all on the defense side. But I think whether the listeners are lawyers or clients themselves, I think we'll have some insights and tips on kind of what you see in malpractice cases, where lawyers go wrong, how to avoid claims, and then what to do if one arises.
Well, could be helpful. Please go ahead.
Well, first, it's something that is a little unique in representing lawyers. It's a fun opportunity to kind of practice law at a high level. Your clients know what you do and know how you do it, and so they're often very engaged in the process. Can also be demanding at times, and certainly present challenges to a litigator. Just because lawyers often have their own way of doing things and are used to being the lawyer and not the client.
Well, I was just about to ask, you often hear that doctors make the worst patients. Is that the case with lawyers?
I wouldn't say the worst patients. I think sometimes lawyers make great clients because, for example, they understand what goes into putting together a winning argument or, when you put together a lengthy brief, they know what that takes. So in many ways, lawyers can be very appreciative. They tend to be easier to deal with on billing issues for that reason. They don't tend to question as many bills because they kind of understand what goes into things. On the other hand, if you have, I've defended a lot of lawyers at depositions, and one of the key things that you have to teach them is, you're not arguing your case anymore. You're responding to questions and you're providing factual answers. So oftentimes if that lawyer is trying to kind of anticipate defenses or advocate his case, the other lawyer is skillful enough that they can kind of lead them down a path, and you have to get the lawyer client to recognize this is a different role, this is a different hat. And because these lawyers have been accused of doing something either ethically improper or not in accordance with the standard of care, for that reason, they tend to be very appreciative clients when you're able to obtain a positive result. So while there are some challenges, I think the benefits outweigh the difficulties. And one of the things I love about the practice is that every case is different. The underlying case is going to be a different real estate transaction, corporate transaction, piece of litigation, immigration representation, whatever you may find. And so it brings a real diversity to what I do every day.
So at a minimum, their reputation is on the line, and at worst, their ability to continue practicing as attorneys.
Well, if you get involved in an ethical issue, that's certainly the case. Often it's just their their reputation in many ways, but also their insurance policy, because, you know, plaintiffs bring these cases to recover damages for something that they think that they lost as a result of the attorney's negligence.
Right. Well, let me ask you, if there is one or even several, what is the most common allegation that you've come across made against attorneys in this malpractice setting?
Right. Well, obviously the underlying cases are always going to be different, but there are a couple of common threads that you see both give rise to a plaintiff that's motivated to assert a claim against an attorney, and also give rise to difficult facts on the defense. And the number one issue there is a conflict of interest, where the attorney is alleged to have put his or her own interests or the interests of another client ahead of the client that obtained the bad result. And then they use that conflict of interest, number one, to motivate them to spend the time and energy necessary to find a lawyer and to start searching around to see whether there is a claim. And then when you do get into a litigation against an attorney, that conflict of interest is generally your worst fact from a jury's perspective. Juries can forgive mistakes, and they can see how maybe a number of factors may have caused the client to lose the case or the transaction to result a certain way. But when the jury sees that conflict of interest, that's something that they like to take a swing at and will really hit the attorneys for. And you see it, with relationships where the client has failed to pay the attorney's bill, mm-hmm. and so the attorney is not working as hard on the case because they're not being paid, and then they lose the case. And of course, not being paid is not a defense for shoddy legal work.
Right.
You also see it with conflicts of interest that are not disclosed. For example, if an attorney or his firm represent another part of the transaction and the conflict search wasn't performed correctly, or something comes up along the way and it's not disclosed, that client can often make hay out of the conflict that on the surface may not appear even that it influenced anything. But remember, attorney conflicts are imputed from one member of the firm to all of the other members. So if your partner out in San Francisco represents an adverse party in your litigation, you've got to identify that and either obtain a waiver or not take the representation.
So it sounds like some of these, particularly with regard to conflicts of interest, may arise not from anything intentionally done by an attorney, but maybe it could be administrative, or they just hadn't taken the time because there are several different offices and a number of clients to determine whether the conflict exists.
That's right. And, a lot of these situations that attorneys find themselves in are failure of internal processes to identify a conflict, or failure to have processes in place that help attorneys avoid second-guessing later. And one of the other common threads I see in attorney malpractice claims is failure to document your advice. If you have provided your client with important advice about a decision in a representation, it's important to document that, because juries expect to see that later on. They think lawyers write memos and lawyers take notes, and so when they don't see those notes, even if you did provide the advice, they're skeptical, and they tend to side with clients. So you can often avoid malpractice claims and short circuit second guessing when you've got that memo to the file that says, "Dear client, these are the options that we discussed. We spoke about these questions, and ultimately, together we determined that this was the proper course of action." When that client later second guesses you, that email, that letter, that document is a key piece of information.
So keeping good records, being able to document, exactly what you're sharing with the client and recommending and advising the client on is one way to help stave off or at least combat, if you can stave off, some of these suits. You also mentioned at the outset that obviously a hit on their malpractice insurance and having to deal with their insurance carriers is part and parcel of these actions. Do you find that most attorneys carry sufficient malpractice insurance?
Generally, yes, but on occasion, no. And I've seen it play out in practice where big firms they're always looking to save, and you often see it in a corporate transaction or in a transaction or litigation where there's a valuation question. And some of these clients, they say as a result of whatever the attorney did, I lost the value in this company or the value of my stock. And at the time it was kind of unknown, but later it showed to be tremendously valuable. And so you can kind of get the damages numbers, climbing up the scale quickly. So it's important that, attorneys and firms evaluate that. And speak with their carrier about what their coverage is, because there have been firms that have seen excess verdicts that have caused significant issues down the road and even caused firms to close.
So would you suggest that law firms, whether they're big, small, or particularly solo practitioners, do periodic checkups with their carriers in case their business model may have changed or things like that? Because I know often individuals are encouraged to reevaluate and assess their insurance needs after a change in jobs or after they have children or big events in their lives. Would you suggest the same with attorneys?
Absolutely, and from the client's perspective as well, that's something that if you bring a large transaction to a law firm, you should ask about and make sure that the law firm has sufficient coverage if something goes wrong.
Oh, that's something I hadn't thought about from the client's perspective. So what do you suggest to attorneys if a client, what's the first thing that you want to know from them if they come to you and say, it looks like I'm being sued for malpractice?
Right. Well, the first thing is that you usually have a sense of it before there's a lawsuit filed. And so, whether it be to your in-house general counsel or to involve someone outside your firm.
Now, is that because many of these matters may settle before they go further? Or?
Well, it's because that generally you see when something's coming down the pike, and you can avoid problems for the litigation later if you can kind of see those things coming by addressing the issue with a client and speaking about what the potential issue is and talking through. Clients may ultimately say, well, that claim wasn't one I was interested in anyway, even if it was something that caused the claim to be lapsed. And so by being proactive, by preserving documents, by understanding that conversations with clients may later come back to haunt you, you can kind of see those issues coming and be proactive and hopefully avoid them.
Oh, well, that sounds good, because clearly attorneys, all professionals, need to be concerned about being able to protect themselves and often find themselves in a position of being sued and having to resort or rely upon their malpractice insurance. So, Peter, thank you so much for coming on this afternoon and sharing your thoughts and experiences as far as particularly attorney malpractice matters are concerned.
Thanks, Todd. I appreciate the opportunity.
Stocks, bonds, investment opportunities, financial news, and talk. We can help. Call us now toll-free, 866-472-5790. 866-472-5790. Voice America Business Network.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
If you find yourself under the Klieg lights of a government investigation, you want experience on your side. Patton Boggs has 46 years of it. We've handled some of the biggest white-collar crime cases. Put that experience to work for you.
Edward Newberry, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
all about action.
Touchdown!
Scores.
Taking a look at the NBA tonight.
Highlights.
He's broken loose. He's at the 30.
And headlines.
Big trade in the NFL this afternoon.
When you are looking to talk sports, look no further than the Voice America Sports Network. We bring you some of the biggest names and all the sports news you can handle, whether it's basketball.
Off the glass.
Football.
Come on.
Golf. Racing. Or the Olympics. We've got you covered. We'll even cover tailgating. Tune in to the Voice America Sports Network. It's all things sports.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
Hear ye, hear ye. The House will come to order.
Having trouble sorting out what's going on Capitol Hill? Patton Boggs can cut through it all. We've got the insight, the know-how, the connections to navigate. Patton Boggs. Straight, unfiltered. Patton Boggs, a bipartisan voice with knowledge and 46 years of experience.
Edward Newberry, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
Voice America Business Network, the bottom line in business.
Live from Washington, it's Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. Join us on the program and weigh in on the topics discussed with your question or comment. The toll-free number is 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also direct your questions or comments via email to koneill@pattonboggs.com. That's K-O-Neill, O-N-E-I-L-L, at pattonboggs.com. Now, back to Capital Thinking.
Good afternoon, listeners, and welcome back to Capital Thinking. I am not Kevin O'Neill, but Todd Cranford, subbing for Kevin this afternoon. And we have with us now on the line Mr. Scott, Mr. Scott Badami, a partner in the Philadelphia-based law firm of Fox Rothschild. For the last 14 years, Scott has devoted significant percentage of his practice to defending clients against allegations of housing discrimination, as well as training housing providers on the Fair Housing Act, or FHA, and its state law counterparts. At some point in their life, most Americans will have rented an apartment, and more than likely, that apartment complex or community was or will be subject to the Fair Housing Act, a federal law designed to prevent and punish discrimination in access to housing. On today's show, Scott will provide an overview of what the Fair Housing Act does and share with us the facts and lessons of a recently concluded case in which a New York City landlord agreed to settle allegations of discrimination based on sex for what is believed to be a record $2 million. Scott, welcome.
Thank you, Todd. I appreciate the opportunity and look forward to speaking with you today.
So, Scott, what is the FHA and who is it designed to protect?
Todd, the FHA, the Fair Housing Act, was passed by Congress initially back in 1968, and the goal of the Fair Housing Act is fairly simple. It's to ensure that all Americans don't face discrimination, don't face troubles in getting housing. That's renting housing, buying housing. It's ensuring that all Americans have equal access to the various housing opportunities in our country.
So it's not just about, you know, renting for those who don't own, but also going through the mortgage process and trying to get financing to purchase a home.
Absolutely. The Fair Housing Act covers all of that, and there are specific standards in the law, and various federal departments regulate and enforce the provisions of the law to ensure that everybody in their housing transaction gets the same fair shot.
Right. And how do you go about in your practice assisting presumably landlords or other management types in dealing with suits when they are brought? And you also, I know, address the kind of the preemptive training aspect of it.
Sure. One of the most important things I do is I work with apartment management, apartment ownership, to try to make sure our employees, our leasing office staff, our maintenance staff, are trained to ensure they know the law because we want to follow the law. A big misconception that can sometimes exist is that for some reason management is against the Fair Housing Act. And frankly, Todd, that's quite the opposite. We absolutely support the Fair Housing Act. When I do training, when I go to conferences, I very much appreciate being the speaker after the government representative, usually from HUD, but it could be from Department of Justice as well,
right?
Because I get to listen to what that speaker says, and I get to stand up. Some people think I'm going to say the government's all wet, when in fact, most of the time, I'm going to say, on behalf of management, we agree with the Fair Housing Act. We want to follow the law. We want to ensure everybody gets the fair opportunity. So that's the biggest point I want to make at the outset. Second thing is training. I actively participate in doing training. We train our management company employees to get it right. We want to get it right. And it can also help prevent cases from ever being filed if you do good training.
Well, speaking of training, let's talk a little bit about this New York City case.
I'd be happy to. One of the things that I do for my clients is I monitor other cases in other jurisdictions around the country in an effort to see just what's going on. And just earlier this month, frankly, the Department of Justice, which is one of the agencies who enforces our Fair Housing Act, entered into a settlement with respect to a New York City case. And as we start to talk about this case, I want to make clear at the outset that this one is egregious. The facts here are not common.
Most of the outlier case.
Yeah, this is an outlier. This is not something that you're going to see every day. But and this is the settlement that was agreed to, and so this is what we're going to work with. But I do want to make clear to you and to your listeners that this is not what I see on my day-to-day business.
Well, after you share kind of what you've referred to as the egregious nature of this case, then talk a little bit about what you do see more commonly.
Sure. The case that settled earlier this month for a total of slightly over $2 million, it's certainly one of, if not the largest, sex discrimination cases that's been settled on behalf of the Fair Housing Act that I've been able to find. Basically, the allegations were, and again, they were just allegations, but they were allegations that the ownership of an apartment building hired a registered sex offender to serve as the superintendent of the properties. While this person was employed as the superintendent, he harassed female tenants. And I want to be clear here that I know this is a family program, so I'll try to make it, I'll try to keep it clean.
There you go.
But what he is alleged to have attempted to do was enter various women's apartments while he was inebriated. He would demand sex. He would engage in unwelcome groping and fondling. He'd subject them to unwanted verbal sexual advances, demanded sexual favors in return for tangible housing benefits, such as a rent reduction, and taking adverse actions against women who refused to comply with his demands for sex. Again, this is the egregious case. This is off the charts. This is not something that you see commonly. Ultimately, as I mentioned, this case settled for just a little over $2 million. The vast majority of that money is going to be put in what's called a victim or a settlement fund. Mm-hmm. And those people who lived in these buildings will submit a claim, and the Department of Justice will essentially be the arbiter of that claim and will then distribute the money to the alleged victims in this case. And that's how it usually works. Another part of the settlement is there is a small, essentially, civil monetary penalty, and there's an injunction, and there's training and things like that.
Now, Scott, if I understand the facts of this case correctly, the fact that management, the ownership of the apartment complex, not just the superintendent's, you know, clearly inappropriate actions, was a big factor in the settlement of this matter, wasn't it?
Absolutely right. And everybody needs to know, if you're in the professional apartment ownership business, you are responsible for the actions of your employees doing work within the scope of their employment. If you hire somebody and that person is working for you, in this case managing an apartment building, acting as a service manager or a superintendent, you are responsible. One of the things I do to advise my clients in cases like this is to ensure you do a criminal background screen on all your potential employees because you want to try to do everything we can to ensure that we're not hiring people who either have, we can call them glitches, problems in their past, or might be somebody who's going to cause a problem in the future.
I always recommend that.
Right, at a minimum,
just making sure that you're not placing them in a position, given their background, that could lead to some liability for you.
Absolutely correct.
Okay, well, this definitely sounds egregious. Even, you know, being a New Yorker, it's hard for anything to surprise you, but the facts of this case definitely surprised me. So let's turn now to discuss a little bit about what you see more commonly in your practice, what types of allegations are made and some of the pitfalls that lay there, and how you would advise clients, you know, broadly to be able to avoid them.
Sure. In my work, and I've been doing this now for just about 14 years, I've seen a change. Traditionally and historically, the largest number of complaints that were filed were race discrimination. That's now changed, and race is second, and disability or handicap is now first. And over the past 10 years, more issues relating to disability cases, claims, requests for reasonable accommodation, requests for reasonable modification, they take up an increasing amount of my time and, frankly, my clients' time. If you are in the professional apartment management or ownership business, you need to ensure that you deal appropriately with reasonable accommodation and reasonable modification requests. Briefly, a reasonable accommodation is a change in a rule or a policy. A reasonable modification is something that has to be constructed or built. If somebody, whether it's a resident,
such as ramps or armrest and things of that nature.
That's exactly right. That's what we do as a modification. You always want to respond to your resident, to your applicant. You always want to ensure that you actively consider. And in our fair housing world, we call engage in the interactive process with our residents. The worst thing you can do is ignore a request. But as I say, what we do is respond to those requests, work to try to see if there is a way to resolve the matter before a fair housing complaint gets filed. Nobody wins when a complaint gets filed. The best thing to do is to work with your leasing office staff. And if you don't get satisfaction there, go to the company's lawyer, someone like me, and we'll try to work it out before a complaint gets filed.
Oh, that's great. Well, Scott, quickly, before our segment ends, one thing I'd like to get from you is you mentioned that Department of Justice often enforces the FHA. What other federal agencies may be able to prosecute or bring actions here? And what's the importance of the kind of corollary state laws?
Every state, many localities also have anti-discrimination statutes. Under the Federal Fair Housing Act, there are seven protected classes: race, color, national origin, religion, sex, familial status, and handicap. But certain states and certainly certain localities add additional protected classes, such as source of income, such as sexual preference, such as military status. And so you need to be careful to ensure you follow the law.
In your locality.
In addition to the Department of Justice, who gets involved in the serious cases, you can also face regulatory issues from the Department of Housing and Urban Development on the federal side. And every state has a Fair Housing Commission, an Equal Opportunity Commission, a human rights agency. Then also many cities and counties have their own local agencies. And so my practice deals, frankly, with all of them. I have a docket of cases from Hawaii to Florida and just about everywhere in between, working with investigators, lawyers, agencies, to try to ensure that problems get solved.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, and so that's what I want to leave, I guess, you and your listeners with, is on behalf of management, we try to get it right. We really, really do. Does that mean we get it right always? No, Todd, it doesn't. But my goal is, on the cases where sometimes we don't get it right, that we fix it. and we can walk away with a good handshake and try to make it right.
Well, that's great. Thank you, Scott Bottomy from Fox Rothschild in Philadelphia, and we'll be back in a moment.
Thank you, Todd.
Thank you.
Whether the market's up or down, or if you're looking to improve your portfolio, our experts are ready to talk to you. Call now, toll free, 866-472-5790. That's 866-472-5790. Voice America Business Network.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
What's your name worth? The loss of a single patent, trademark, or copyright can cost millions. Make sure your intellectual property is protected. Trust Patton Boggs to manage and protect your most important assets.
Edward Newberry, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
Are you looking for innovative ideas on how to achieve your financial dreams? Tune in to Empirical Investing Radio every Thursday afternoon at 2 Pacific, 5 Eastern on the Voice America Business Channel. Join certified financial planners Ken Smith and Ethan Broga to learn how you can obtain financial success. You'll be entertained while you discover techniques to alleviate your financial concerns. Empirical Investing Radio every Thursday at 2 Pacific, 5 Eastern on the Voice America Business Channel.
Technology is changing the way we live our lives and how we do business. On CIO Talk Radio, we talk about the benefits of technology and the great things it allows us to do, as well as its risks. Heard every Wednesday at 9 a.m. Central, 7 a.m. Pacific, Sunjoe Gall interviews business leaders and other experts that are shaping the way we use technology. To learn more about the show, visit www.ciotalkradio.com. Keep up with the changing world of technology and listen to CIO Talk Radio with Sunjoe Gall. Listen in every Wednesday at 9 a.m. Central, 7 a.m. Pacific, right here on Voice America Business.
The business community's first choice in Internet Talk Radio, Voice America Business Network.
From Washington, it's Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. Join us on the program and weigh in on the topics discussed with your question or comment. The toll-free number is 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also direct your questions or comments via email to koneill@pattonboggs.com. That's koneill, O-N-E-I-L-L, at pattonboggs.com. Now, back to Capital Thinking.
Good afternoon, listeners, and welcome back to this week's edition of Capital Thinking. I am Todd Cranford, guest hosting for my colleague Kevin O'Neill. And continuing now with our theme of kind of professional services and advice, we have with us Mr. Adrian Dayton, an attorney and professional coach to law firms. Adrian's on a mission, evangelizing on behalf of social media for the legal profession. He's a former practicing attorney who's now a professional consultant to some of the largest and most well-respected firms in the U.S., Australia, and New Zealand. He is also a published author on social media and is a weekly columnist for the National Law Journal and a monthly writer for Technolawyer's Big Law newsletter. Welcome, Adrian.
Hey, welcome. Good morning. Thanks so much for having me on.
Great. We're pleased to have you with us today, and I understand you're going to be talking about the increasingly important relationship between law firms and social media.
Yeah, that's right. And when it comes to law firms, I mean, relationships are king for lawyers and for law firms, and so, you know, that's why it's really such an important topic right now.
And when you say relationships, you mean relationships professional, peer-to-peer, and, of course, among their clients, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think, you know, for over 100 years, I mean, for as long as we've had lawyers, you know, their credibility has been based on their reputation and on their ability to build strong relationships with clients.
And so obviously using all the number, the varied social media outlets that are available now can do a great service or a great harm, I imagine, if not used properly or if not monitored properly.
Absolutely. I mean, I often hear this concern with, are we monitoring our lawyers properly on social media? And I think for most major law firms, it's kind of a red herring. Really, the concern shouldn't be, what are our lawyers doing wrong on social media? The concern should be, we have some really outstanding lawyers in our firm, but nobody knows about them because they're not very good at getting out there and getting known online.
And how do you help them with that?
Well, I think it all starts with asking the key kind of business development question, which is, who is your ideal client? And really understanding well, what your ideal client thinks about, what they worry about. You know, we hear this phrase too much, but, what keeps them up at night? What types of information do they digest? What types of things do they read and do they need to learn about to be better at their jobs? And from there, there's really two valuable things that lawyers can do. And I think of these as kind of the two key metrics that they can be judged by for how well they use social media. The first is to provide quality touches with those ideal clients. And a quality touch can be as simple as writing an article and emailing it to them or tweeting it or sharing it with them, where they're able to read it. It adds value to them. It helps them and leaves them with a positive impression of that lawyer. So, I mean, that's kind of the first thing lawyers can do with social media. And the second thing, I really can't emphasize this enough, but social media needs to be a tool that's used to facilitate offline meetings. The point of being online is not to keep us out of having to have offline meetings, but it's to help us meet people we never would have met otherwise and then turn those meetings into phone calls, into, coffee, into lunch, and into new engagements.
Right, and thereby establishing what many would consider the more traditional relationships as opposed to just the kind of ephemeral, in the ether relationships that some have on or fear they will have on the social networks.
Yeah, that's right. And I spoke to a law firm in Grand Rapids yesterday, and one of the lawyers raised his hand and he said, look, I know we're supposed to spend a lot of time on business development each week. Are you proposing that we should eventually be using all of that time for social media and blogging? And I said to him, absolutely not. This is meant to complement those other activities and hopefully accentuate, where you have strengths in relationship building. Social media really can be a tool to help accentuate that.
Yeah, and that I think is a segue into a question that I wanted to ask you. It seems to me law firms are notoriously averse to change. Are you met with much resistance when you first approach law firms, especially some of the more established ones in whatever subject area, whatever part of the country, about the idea of establishing a greater online presence?
So, kind of to break apart your question into a couple pieces, do I encounter, resistance to change? Absolutely. In every single organization I speak to, every single audience I speak to, there's resistance. There's people in the audience, that are skeptical. And, even the firms that hire me, generally the firms that hire me are, among the firms that are looking to be more innovative or are clearly more innovative than their competitors. But even among those firms, there's always resistance. Lawyers, they're very intelligent and they're very capable people. And so it can be hard to tell them that something that they've been doing for so many years that works well, needs to be changed. And so I really think the best way to really bring about that change in individuals, because it starts with the individuals and then it can kind of build out to the organization. But the way to change the individuals is to help them understand how these tools can really fit into their existing framework and help them take what they're very best at, which is taking complex ideas and making them simple and using these tools then to showcase that ability.
Right, right. And I think that's obviously, it sounds like much of your clientele is kind of self-selected. You said those that are already a little more forward-thinking or those that have decided that they want and need to be more forward-thinking. Do you spend any or much time at all trying to convince, you know, the Luddites of the, yeah, of the law firms that they need to get, you know, at least closer to the 21st century, if not in it?
Yeah, you know, that's a good question. And I think this is an issue that every single, you know, marketing director or, you know, managing partner of the law firm deals with, is that in every firm, if you think about this as a bell curve, right, at the very beginning of the bell curve, you have the innovators. At the very end of the bell curve, you have what they call the laggards, right? Those are the people that up until, you know, 3 months ago were still, you know, dictating their letters to their secretary, right? Mm-hmm. And what happens is if you focus your attention on the laggards, you're not going to get a very good return on your time. And so oftentimes those laggards will take up all of the attention, will take up all of the meeting time in pushing back against these initiatives. And so I find it's actually much more effective to ignore those laggards for now and focus on the self-selected group that are ready to move forward. You know, so if you have a firm of 100 people, you may have 10 or 15 laggards in that group. Well, you know, don't worry about them. They'll be fine and they'll survive doing what they're doing for now. You know, work on the people that are close, that realize there is something to the social media. They just need a little bit more direction because, you know, that's where you're going to have the most, you're going to have results that will be meaningful, if that makes sense.
No, I think that makes sense. So give us a sense of, you know, once a firm has has retained you to
sure.
come in and work with them, what's the first thing you usually advise them to do, and what's the most preferred social media tool among law firms?
Yeah, good question. So, you know, kind of to start with that last part first, the kind of easy point of entry where I have them start is LinkedIn. I say, look, all of your lawyers should have a LinkedIn account, and they don't need to spend hours and hours building it up, but every LinkedIn profile needs three things. It needs to have an up-to-date picture, needs to have your completed experience and educational information, and then it needs to have a summary to explain, you know, what you do and what you're all about. You know, that's kind of your bio on LinkedIn. And if you have those three things, then your LinkedIn profile has the appearance of being somewhat complete, so that if someone's looking for a lawyer and comes across it, they'll get a good sense of what you're about. And so, you know, that's something, even the Luddites, you can have you know, a marketing assistant go and sit down with them and help them get that finished.
Well, I think our segment is about to end, but before we leave, Adrian, I want to ask you, how do you think law firms will do business in the next 5 to 10 years? You know, how is social media going to change how they do business over the next several years?
Well, I think it comes down to value. And, you know, when lawyers blog, they add value not just to their clients, but the legal industry in general. And I think that is going to become an expectation. You know, great lawyers are going to be expected to blog and share their insights with the world. And I mean, on the one hand, they're going to be giving away free information.
I was going to say that runs counter to what they've grown accustomed to.
That's it. On the one hand, they'll be giving away free information. But on the other hand, the best lawyers will be seen as those who are the most generous and the real thought leaders will only be those who are willing to share some of their insights with the world.
Ah, well, great. Well, Andrew, why don't you tell our listeners how they can reach you if they have an interest?
Yeah, sounds great. Well, they can go to my website, adriandayton.com, or they can email me, info@adriandayton.com, or read my weekly columns in the National Law Journal. But, hey, thank you so much for having me on. Really enjoyed the conversation.
Well, thank you very much, and hopefully it was useful for our listeners. Thanks, and we'll be back.
Sounds good. Thank you.
Bye-bye now.
Bye. whether the market's up or down, or if you're looking to improve your portfolio, our experts are ready to talk to you. Call now, toll free, 866-472-5790. That's 866-472-5790. Voice America Business Network.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
From K Street to Wall Street to LaSalle Street, the Patton Boggs team knows how to pull off big business transactions. Come hear what we know. Patton Boggs covers the world.
Edward Newberry, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000. The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
Interrogatories.
Prima facie.
Pleadings.
Motion for summary judgment.
E-discovery.
Affirmative defense.
Stipulations.
Ex parte.
Amicus brief.
Subpoena.
Litigation is confusing. Trust the litigation team at Patton Boggs to make sense of it all.
Edward Newberry, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000. The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
The same firm that's been navigating the government maze for more than four decades is also the same firm that can help you protect your most important assets. Whether it's a valuable patent, an important copyright, or your next big idea, Patton Boggs is committed to protecting your intellectual property.
Edward Newberry, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
When it comes to business, you'll find the experts here. Voice America Business Network. From Washington, it's Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. Join us on the program and weigh in on the topics discussed with your question or comment. The toll-free number is 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also direct your questions or comments via email to koneill@pattonboggs.com. That's K-O-Neill, O-N-E-I-L-L, at pattonboggs.com. Now, back to Capital Thinking.
Good afternoon, everyone. This is Todd Cranford, not Kevin O'Neill. I'm guest hosting for Kevin this week, and we are continuing with some useful and timely advice for many individuals regarding estate planning and income protection. We have now Jennifer Gurevitz, who's an associate with Looper, Reed, and McGraw. Jennifer serves clients across the broad range of taxation law with special emphasis on federal income and estate tax transactions and tax controversy work. Her practice involves all aspects of business tax planning, including the formation, restructuring, and maintenance of partnerships, limited liability companies, and corporations. Well, welcome, Jennifer. How are you this afternoon?
I'm doing well. Thank you, Todd, for having me on.
Thanks so much for joining us. Jennifer, as I just mentioned, today we'll focus on the important aspects of estate planning and asset protection with some changes that are coming forward. I believe you said in 2013 in the tax code?
Correct, starting in January 1st, 2013.
2013, so that's right around the corner.
Mm-hmm. Correct.
Uh-huh. So go ahead, why don't you open with sharing with us what some of these important changes are and who should be thinking about them.
Okay. Well, there's many changes that are going to occur on January 1st, 2013 with this new health care law that President Obama passed. One of these changes is that it's going to increase the Medicare tax of 3.8% on unearned income and 0.9% on earned income. And these changes are for taxpayers that make more than $200,000 individually or $250,000 in joint returns. Now, this change affects entities for asset protection planning for dental practices, because generally you want the important aspect of asset protection planning is first choosing the proper vehicle to hold the dental practice. Most dental practices are either formed as limited liability companies or LLCs or S corporations. Generally, an S corporation has to pay reasonable compensation to its dentist employees, but can pay the rest out as distributions. So therefore, that the amount that's paid out as distributions is not subject to this new 0.9% tax on earned income.
Right. I'm sorry to interrupt, but I want to ask, is there something in particular that is special about dentists, or does this apply to other similarly situated professionals?
It applies to all similar situated professionals, dentists, physicians, lawyers. You know, earlier in your show, you talked about malpractice insurance and malpractice cases for lawyers. It would apply to them as well.
So that means there are a lot of people who need to be aware of and planning for, you know, how they are going to best protect their assets going forward.
Correct, correct. So generally, you know, with this new law, you would save that 0.9% on distributions from an S corporation, but for asset protection planning purposes, there are more benefits to forming the entity as an LLC, or limited liability company. One of these benefits is for an LLC, if you have a lawsuit, a creditor can only get a charging order against the LLC interest. Whereas if you're an S corporation, the creditor can actually come in and take your stock in the S corporation. So that makes a big difference.
Right, and what kind of considerations would the dentist or some other professional want to be thinking about, other than what you just mentioned, in determining which form of incorporation and doing business is most appropriate for them?
Well, generally, I mean, you need this for malpractice, but again, you have malpractice insurance for that. But for example, if there's a, you know, business practices, if there's an example of a claim of harassment by an employee, or if you have a dispute with your partners in your business, or in the event of divorce or a car accident, you're going to want to form one of these entities, either an S corporation or an LLC. And again, I think the main thing to talk about your advisor with is whether you want to look at these tax ramifications or talking about the, you know, creditor protection. You get the creditor protection both ways in forming the S corporation or the LLC, but the charging order is a big difference.
And would those considerations be similar for those dentists who are thinking about retiring or transferring their practice?
Yes, actually, it's beneficial to have, you know, your practice formed as an S corporation or an LLC when you're thinking about retiring or transferring your practice, because one of the things you want to be able to have in place is a good buy-sell agreement. You know, with dentists or other professionals pass away, their goodwill goes out the door with them. And so we want to be able to use that goodwill while they're still alive and keep the value of the practice up for the dentist's children and grandchildren.
And what can a dentist do to protect his or her family in the event that, you know, they become incapacitated and unable to practice any further short of retirement?
One good thing is disability insurance, of course. Life insurance, generally, you know, as an estate planner, we would recommend putting a life insurance into an irrevocable life insurance trust. And this will hold the policy. It won't be subject to creditors, which is another good asset protection planning, and it also will not be in the dentist's estate. Speaking of trust, there's one other big change that's coming in 2013 that I wanted to address. Currently, we have a $5 million gift tax exemption. This goes away in 2013. It goes back to $1 million. So speaking of this gift tax exemption in terms of asset protection planning, one good thing about asset protection planning is to give your property away, which no one really wants to do because then you don't have the property anymore, of course. But there are ways to keep the assets in your family and still protect them from creditors. So, for example, a dentist can form what we call a spousal limited access trust, where the dentist can create the trust for the benefit of his spouse or children, and the spouse or children have access to it. The dentist no longer does, but it's protected from creditors.
Right, and you're saying that the value of transferable property is decreasing back to $1 million from $5 million?
Exactly. Exactly, and that takes effect January 1st, 2013 as well.
Meaning any transfers post January 1st?
Any transfers in excess of $1 million post January 1st will be subject to gift tax.
Right, okay.
And so we want to take advantage of it this year, giving away property. And that's, you know, generally the asset protection and estate planning. You know, if dentists or other professionals have property that they can give away, now's the time to do it.
Sounds like I need to go and find $5 million worth of property to be able to give away.
Yes, I guess I'm sure your family would be very happy if you did.
Right, in some respects, that's not a bad problem to have. But I hear where the chime letting me know that we're about to wrap up here. But this has been, I think, useful information for individuals and for many of the professionals and corporations out there to start thinking about trying to plan in advance to not only minimize tax hits, but to preserve income at a future date. So thank you very much, Jennifer, for joining us.
Thank you for having me on.
And thank you to the staff at Voice of America. Please come back next week for Voice of America's Capital Thinking. I'm Todd Cranford, signing off for my colleague Kevin O'Neill. Thanks and have a great day.
Thank you for joining us for Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. We hope to have you join us again for more insight from Washington. We're here every Thursday at 9 a.m. Pacific Time, noon Eastern, on the Voice America Business Network.